The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be reached at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the January 22nd, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows, you can just see the top of the U.S. Capitol. In the foreground are a gallows with a noose hanging from it. There's a man in camouflage jacket and a red hat. He's leading Uncle Sam up the steps of the gallows. He's got his wrist bound together with a cable tie. He's got a black eye. He's looking kind of beat up. And around the gallows is an angry mob. There's a QAnon sign. There's a pair of banners. One says 1776, give us liberty or death. The other says Trump, make America great again. And the headline is Insurrection, How Trumpism Devolved into Domestic Terrorism. And that is our first main story. The Trumpist insurrection at the Capitol. What happened? The Trump presidency was in full collapse this week as fallout mounted from an insurrection by thousands of Trump supporters who launched an assault on the U.S. Capitol, killing a police officer, injuring dozens more, and leaving the nation deeply shaken. Before the riot, President Trump told a crowd of rabid supporters the election had been stolen and to march on the Capitol, warning, "If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." A mob of thousands then smashed windows, broke down doors, ransacked offices, smeared feces in hallways, and sent panicked lawmakers into hiding, delaying the certification of Joe Biden's election win. Armed with flex cuffs and tasers, some sought out Vice President Mike Pence and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Several legislators who only narrowly escaped the mob said they feared for their lives. Five people died in the melee, including a police officer attacked with a fire extinguisher and a QAnon follower shot by police. Rioters were seen beating a prone cop with sticks and an American flag. Others erected a gallows and noose outside the Capitol to hang Pence and other traitors. More than 70 of the rioters, whose ranks included firefighters, police officers, active duty military, and business owners, along with members of militias and white supremacist groups, have been arrested. And charges may include trespass, assault on police, theft of national security information, and felony murder. The number of arrests will grow geometrically, said the acting U.S. Attorney in Washington, Michael Sherwin. The gamut of cases we're looking at is mind-blowing. Blowback against Trump and his congressional allies came on multiple fronts. The House impeached Trump for the second time. Over a dozen administration officials resigned, including Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, and former Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. The PGA pulled its 2022 championship from Trump's New Jersey golf club, and Trump's longtime creditor, Deutsche Bank, said it would no longer do business with him. Meanwhile, law enforcement officials warned lawmakers of a host of ominous new threats, including plots to disrupt the inauguration, attack state capitals, and harm elected officials. The nation faces a continuing crisis, said Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin. It is not over yet. What the editorial said. President Trump has abased his office and should be finished as a serious political figure, said the Wall Street Journal. He incited a direct assault on the cornerstone of our democracy, the peaceful transfer of power. When his followers turned violent, he declined for far too long to call them off. When he finally addressed the mob, he spouted more lies about a stolen election. All this crosses a constitutional line and is impeachable. He doesn't have the grace to resign, but he should. Trump's congressional enablers are complicit in the deadly violence, said St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Senators Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, and other two-faced, lying populist politicians failed repeatedly to stand up and condemn Trump's dangerous rhetoric. Now they deserve to be cast into political purgatory. These same Republicans are suddenly calling for unity and healing, said the Washington Post. There is a minimum price of entry for reconciliation. Issue an unequivocal acknowledgement that there was no vote rigging and that Joe Biden won fair and square. What the columnist said. Responsibility for this horrific spectacle falls squarely on Trump, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. He incited his followers for weeks with baseless claims of election fraud, misled them into believing Pence could alter the outcome of the certification vote, and then sent them seething with rage to the Capitol. At each step, Trump could have steered his supporters away from violent confrontation. At each step, he chose the opposite path. The blame runs far deeper than Trump, said Zach Bocamp in Vox.com. The Capitol Hill mob was the logical culmination of years of mainstream Republican politics. For years, the GOP has vilified Democrats as extremists who represent an existential threat to America and whose election victories are inherently fraudulent. That delegitimizing rhetoric has long fueled the conservative movement, and the Capitol violence was the logical next step. This was about more than anger over a single election, said Hakeem Jefferson in 538.com. It was an explosion of rage by whites who see their dominance threatened by the multiracial coalition of Americans who brought Biden to power. Carrying Confederate flags, they weren't fighting just to defend Trump, but also to defend a white America whose hold on power has become increasingly precarious. The overriding question now, said Charlie Sykes in TheBulwark.com, is whether this was a last gasp of the Trumpist era or the beginning of something ugly. Faced with the consequence of putting a demagogue in power, some Republicans are crawling out from the detritus of Trumpism and trying to return to a modicum of sanity. But we remain a deeply divided country, and dark days may lie ahead. Unfortunately, it is just one small step from coup d'etat to civil war. We'll read a second main story. House impeaches Trump again. What happened? House lawmakers voted to impeach President Donald Trump for a second time this week on a charge of incitement of insurrection, with 10 Republicans joining Democrats in a historic 237-197 vote. The House charged Trump with inciting supporters to attack the U.S. Capitol and also cited other efforts to subvert and obstruct the certification of the election results, specifically detailing a January 2nd phone call in which Trump demanded that Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger fined 11,780 votes. The House moved to impeachment after Vice President Mike Pence refused to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove Trump from office. Representative Liz Cheney, the Democrat from Wyoming, the third-ranking House Republican, said Trump lit the flame of this attack and that there had never been a greater betrayal by a president. An unrepentant Trump said his comments before the insurrection were totally appropriate and warned that his impeaching him was causing tremendous anger among his supporters. The Senate remains in recess until January 19 and will not reconvene beforehand. A Senate conviction, which could include language barring Trump from holding office again, requires a two-thirds vote. Several Republicans have signaled they could vote against Trump, including current Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. President-elect Joe Biden asked the Senate to split time between the upcoming trial and his agenda and nominations. "We're going to have to do several things at once," said Chuck Schumer, who will take over as majority leader. What the columnist said: Trump's grip on Republicans is clearly fizzling out, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Not only did 10 Republicans in the House vote to impeach, but McConnell, a key Trump ally for most of his term, is reportedly pleased that Democrats impeached Trump and told GOP colleagues he will decide whether to convict based on the legal arguments. McConnell is said to blame Trump for costing Republicans the Senate and feels impeachment will make it easier for the Republican Party to move on. Yes, Trump must be held accountable, said Kaylee McGee in WashingtonExaminer.com. But impeachment is more trouble than it's worth. Like it or not, 74 million people voted for Trump, and most still believe his lies about election fraud. Removing him from office would only strengthen their belief the government is out to get them and drive them deeper into Trump's web, when the goal should be extricating them from it as quickly as possible. Impeachment still may not be the best strategy to keep Trump from holding office again, said Bruce Ackerman and Gerard Magliocca in the Washington Post. There's a less divisive, simpler, and more effective means of sanctioning Trump. The 14th Amendment was passed in 1866 to prohibit former Confederate officers and officials from holding office. To invoke it, the Senate would need only a simple majority rather than two-thirds demanded by impeachment. Our controversy of the week is Georgia runoffs, what a Democratic Senate means for Biden. It was understandably overshadowed by the storming of the U.S. Capitol, but it's hard to overstate the importance of what happened the night before in Georgia, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. Democrats won both Senate runoff elections in that former Republican stronghold last week, securing unified control of government and ending Mitch McConnell's reign as Senate Majority Leader. And they did so with two candidates who stand as harbingers of how much the country is changing. Reverend Raphael Warnock is only the second black senator ever elected from a former Confederate state. John Ossoff, meanwhile, will be the first Jewish senator from the South since the 19th century. And at 33, the youngest new senator since Joe Biden in 1972. Democrats should profusely thank activist Stacey Abrams, who led a tireless six-year effort to register Democratic voters in Georgia, said Jennifer Rubin in Washington Post. But President Trump also deserves credit. His shameful post-defeat claims that America's electoral system was fraudulent probably depressed Republican turnout and made the difference between a GOP and Democratic Senate majority. What sweet cosmic justice. The win gives Democrats an immediate expectations problem, said Jennifer Habercorn in the Los Angeles Times. With Congress and the White House now in Democratic hands, the party's progressives will demand ambitious wish list items, such as the Green New Deal and statehood for Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. But with a wafer-thin 10-seat majority in the House and a 50-50 tie in the Senate, only Vice President Kamala Harris' tie-breaking vote gives Democrats control. Those plans are likely moot. Still, the Georgia victories reshape the political landscape, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Until last week, it seemed Biden's greatest achievement would be saving the country from a second Trump term. Now, thanks to Georgia, he can have a real presidency. With Democratic control of the Senate, Biden can appoint cabinet members, federal judges, and Supreme Court justices without obstruction. But the filibuster for legislation remains in effect, requiring 60 votes to overcome. So unless centrist Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia drops his opposition to scrapping it, passing actual laws will be much harder. But Biden may find willing partners in moderate GOP senators such as Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski. And Senate rules should let Democrats pass at least one budget reconciliation bill, a sweeping law that could deliver pandemic relief, shore up Obamacare, and raise taxes on the wealthy. Conservatives should be nervous, said the New York Post in an editorial. If there's a single defection, death or retirement in the GOP caucus, Democrats can go radical despite Manchin. While Democrats look to the future, Republicans need a post-mortem, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. In November, Ossoff received 2% fewer votes than GOP incumbent David Perdue, but he beat Perdue by 1% last week. What accounts for this three-point swing? Was it mainly the fact that Trump himself wasn't on the ballot, even though both Perdue and Loeffler ran as Trump loyalists? With Trump headed off to exile and disgrace, a GOP whose brand is Trumpism without Trump will be in big trouble. Let Georgia be a lesson for the GOP, said Kaylee McGee, White and WashingtonExaminer.com. Unless conservatives want to follow Trump into political wilderness, it's time to start disentangling themselves from the anchor weighing them down. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for metrosexuals after a Trump spokesman told Fox News that the heavily made up, intricately coiffed, very chubby 45th president is, quote, the most masculine person ever to hold the White House. It was a good week for rescue dogs, which had become so popular during the pandemic because of the human need for companionship that animal shelters are running out of them. They're going like hotcakes, said Cindy Sharpley of Last Chance Animal Rescue in Maryland. And it was a good week for play selection after New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick canceled plans to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Trump at the White House. Formerly a Trump supporter, Belichick, 68, said he could not accept a medal from this president while remaining true to the people, team, and country I love. But it was a bad week for taking a stand after a lawyer for Adam Johnson, 36, arrested after the Capitol riot, agreed that the instantly iconic photograph of his client cheerfully carrying off Speaker Nancy Pelosi's lectern could be a problem for his defense. I'm not a magician, said attorney Dan Eckhart. It was a bad week for denial after Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, 87, filed formal paperwork to run for another six-year term in 2024. You do get older, that's true, said Feinstein, who reportedly has been told by fellow Democrats she is showing signs of cognitive decline. Finally, it was a bad week for Axe body spray after a can of the fragrant masculine deodorant was photographed lying among the wreckage of the Capitol riot. Axe's makers felt a need to state that we believe in the democratic process and the peaceful transition of power. On the briefing page, we have the pandemic windfall. Large companies and the very rich made a killing last year, while the U.S. wealth gap became wider than ever. Who has benefited? Tech giants, many major corporations, and Wall Street investors have had eye-popping gains during the pandemic, even as the COVID-19 recession has devastated major sectors of the economy. Apple's total stock value climbed to $2.29 trillion, up 133% since March. Amazon's share price increased by 70%. As the stock market set records, fueled by stuck-at-home Americans dependent on online shopping and aggressive Federal Reserve interventions, the fortunes of the 659 U.S. billionaires grew by more than $1 trillion, making the elite group's wealth nearly double that of the bottom 50% of Americans, 165 million people. Meanwhile, just 12 million jobs of the 22 million lost last spring have been recovered, and more than 400,000 small businesses have closed for good. Economists predict a K-shaped recovery, with the poor getting poorer and the rich getting richer, especially those at the very top. Who did best? Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos' net worth has rocketed up $70 billion to an estimated $182 billion. And four men have joined him in the ranks of centibillionaires: Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, whose wealth increased by about 80%, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, who made about $20 billion, French luxury brand tycoon Bernard Arnault, whose fortune doubled to $117 billion, and Tesla CEO Elon Musk, the world's richest man as of last week. With investors betting that the pandemic will accelerate the shift to electric cars, Musk's net worth grew from $24.6 billion in March to $185 billion now, perhaps the fastest accumulation of wealth ever. Google's Larry Page and Oracle's Larry Ellison saw their wealth grow by a mere 40%. Why the big payday? Life under quarantine has been a boon for e-commerce retailers like Amazon, Target, Walmart, and Best Buy. Food delivery services like DoorDash and streaming services like Netflix. Restless consumers not spending money on restaurants and travel are splurging at Home Depot and Lowe's for home improvement projects and on video games for escapism. Restaurant chains that prioritize drive-through and takeout, like McDonald's and Popeyes, are thriving, while communication services like Zoom and Slack hit the jackpot when millions of Americans began working from home. Independent merchants and brick-and-mortar retailers can barely compete because of pandemic restrictions and well-funded public fear of indoor gatherings, and have lost so much market share that it could put them at a permanent dire disadvantage. Once you kill competition, it's always hard to restore it, said Matt Stoller, director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project. This is an extinction-level event for small businesses. How are workers faring? Depends on their tax bracket. White-collar job losses were mostly recovered by late summer, while millions of low-wage workers remain out of work, especially in restaurant, hotel, and other service industries. The majority of last year's layoffs occurred at small businesses, millions of which could go under as massive COVID-19 surges forced states to reimpose safety restrictions. Those crackdowns led the U.S. to lose 140,000 jobs in December, the first month of losses since the early months of the pandemic. 10 encampments of homeless people dot cities across the U.S., and in the week before Thanksgiving, 26 million adults said their households were short on food. Is the wealth gap widening? Profoundly. About 84% of stocks owned by U.S. households are held by the wealthiest 10% of Americans. Without the chance to spend their money eating out, attending cultural events and ball games, or traveling, affluent Americans have every incentive to save and invest. Millions of workers, on the other hand, have lost jobs or seen their hours or pay reduced and are barely scraping by. Nearly 12 million renters owe thousands in back rent and utilities, according to Moody's Analytics. The $2.2 trillion relief package that Congress passed in March initially caused overall poverty to decline thanks to a $1,200 stimulus checks and $600 weekly federal unemployment supplement. By August, however, poverty had returned to pre-pandemic levels. How does the future look? For big corporations, bright. Wall Street is bullish, expecting a recovery similar to the one that followed the 2008 crisis, when large banks and private equity firms gobbled up weakened competitors at fire sale prices, and the top 1% of earners took in 95% of income gains made from 2009 to 2012. Inequality scholar Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies said that as consumers learn to depend entirely on giant corporations, it becomes increasingly difficult for damaged small businesses to compete, resulting in empty downtowns and more wealth concentrated among conglomerates and billionaires. We're at risk of seeing an oligarchic death spiral, Collins said. Read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Garland's huge task at justice. If he's confirmed as the new U.S. Attorney General, Merrick Garland will have one of the toughest jobs in the Biden administration, said Chris Trowell. President-elect Joe Biden's nominee to head Justice Department is widely respected for his careful, thoughtful, and centrist jurisprudence over 25 years as an appellate court judge in the District of Columbia. Before that, as a federal prosecutor, he oversaw several major domestic terrorism cases, including the Oklahoma City bombing, experience that will serve him well in a nation now threatened by white supremacist violence. Garland, of course, is best known as President Obama's nominee to fill Antonin Scalia's Supreme Court seat, the nomination that was balked by Republicans for 293 days. He will head a critically important department that was left in ruins by Donald Trump and Attorney General William Barr, who blatantly used its powers as a tool to protect the president and punish his opponents. Garland clearly understands the stakes he faces. At his nomination press conference, Garland vowed to protect the independence of the department from partisan influence and to establish clear new guidelines for FBI investigations and federal prosecutors. What a refreshing change that would be. What does the GOP stand for? As Republicans once again become the party of opposition, said Ramesh Panuru, they need to offer an alternative vision. With the Democrats holding very thin majorities in the House and Senate, the GOP will no doubt fight Joe Biden's proposed tax increases, environmental regulations, expansion of Obamacare, and immigration policies. As the small government party, Republicans have often chosen not to adopt specific policy proposals to pressing problems, and that has cost them politically. When Obamacare passed, for example, Republicans pledged to repeal and replace it. But a decade later, they have never united behind any health care plan. The GOP failed to resolve how high a priority it should be to ensure high levels of insurance coverage or how to protect people with pre-existing conditions. In 2018, Republican incoherence on health care helped drive a blue wave that gave Democrats the House. If Republicans hope to regain power, opposition to the Democrats' ideas will not be enough. If those of us who are not progressives don't have a different sense of how our country should be governed, then why are we engaged in politics in the first place? This is an international How They See Us column. a riot that revealed U.S. hypocrisy. The city on the hill has lost its shine, said Konstantin Kosachev from Russia. The political system that is supposedly the envy of the world was stripped of its sacredness last week when a mob of Trump supporters assaulted the U.S. Capitol, killing a police officer and endangering lawmakers as they certified Joe Biden's election win. American politicians and pundits decried the violent protest as a horror, even though they routinely praise such displays in other countries as valid outpourings of anger against undemocratic regimes. Now U.S. voters are crying fraud and injustice and besieging government buildings. Americans have tasted the fruits of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and their virginity cannot be restored. U.S. democracy is forever tainted, said Yevgeny Shestakov, also from Russia. The November election that ostensibly went for Biden was opaque because numerous states changed voting rules on a whim. No wonder President Donald Trump's supporters feel cheated. From now on, any party that loses an election will be able to plausibly claim that the results were rigged. The U.S. has lost its right to criticize other countries that quash riots, said Ai Jun from China. Remember when Hong Kong protesters broke into the city's legislative building in 2019? At the time, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the scene a beautiful sight, while Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the U.S. stood with the activists and supported their freedom of expression. Yet when the very same thing occurred in the U.S., they define it as lawlessness and call it unacceptable. China was also smeared and criticized for arresting rioters, even though, unlike their American counterparts, Hong Kong police never fatally shot a protester. What's particularly shocking, said Jafar Blouri from Iran, is that the U.S. is now muzzling both the protesters and the president. Facebook and Twitter, under pressure from Congress, erased Trump from their sites and purged many of his followers. Yes, you heard right. The biggest pretender to democracy and freedom of expression in the world, the one that censures others for supposedly attacking the free press, overnight became the biggest censor in the world. Democracy is America's most important brand, said Ore Egin from Turkey, and Trump has damaged it, perhaps fatally. Lebanese diplomat Mohammed Safa tweeted that the events of January 6 in any other country would invite a U.S. invasion. Others joked that the reason the coup did not succeed was that there was no U.S. embassy in Washington to back it. America is now an object of pity and disdain, and nobody is more delighted than Russian President Vladimir Putin, who has long insisted that the U.S. political system is just as flawed and corrupt as Russia's. I am no conspiracy theorist, but now I wonder, could Trump really be Russia's man? By mutilating American democracy, Trump has given Putin all he ever wanted. The last word feature article is a Washington Post piece that chronicles the, in some detail, the events of the day of the riot. It's titled, Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy? The Capitol Police had assured Congress that rioters wouldn't be able to get in, said Karun Demirjian in the Washington Post. Then the mob broke through, and elected representatives and staff had to run and hide. The growing crowds outside the Capitol on Wednesday afternoon sounded menacing, but at bay as senators began to debate challenges to the Electoral College vote. A top advisor to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell stepped out of the ornate chamber for a short break. Alone in the Capitol's marble halls just outside the chamber's bronze doors, it was suddenly apparent that the citadel of U.S. democracy was falling to the mob incited by President Donald Trump. A cacophony of screaming, shouting, and banging echoed from the floor below. McConnell's security detail rushed past and into the chamber. The advisor began walking toward the rotunda and came face to face with a U.S. Capitol police officer sprinting in the opposite direction. The two made eye contact, and the officer forced out a single word: run. The aide to McConnell darted down a side hallway lined with offices. He jiggled one locked doorknob, then another. A co-worker poked his head out of the office of McConnell's speechwriter. The advisor lunged, pushing him and the colleague back inside. The screaming and shouting soon seemed right outside. Only then a text from the Capitol Police blared on every phone in the room. Due to security threat inside, immediately move inside your office, take emergency equipment, lock the doors, take shelter. Three senior GOP aides piled furniture against the door and tried to move stealthily, worried that the intruders would discover them inside. In waves, the door to the hall heaved as rioters punched and kicked it. The crowd yelled, "Stop the steal!" Some chanted menacingly, referring to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, "Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy?" Peering out a window into a courtyard below, the advisor could see scores of people still streaming in, and no police in sight. Armed with only their phones and some of the best Rolodexes in the world, lawmakers and their aides began calling and texting anyone they thought could help. The Secretary of the Army, the Acting Attorney General, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, governors of nearby states, the District Mayor. The McConnell advisor began calling and texting former top officials at the Justice Department. Speaking in a whisper, he told one the situation was dire. If backup did not arrive soon, people could die. On the day of the rally, lawmakers and their aides had already prepared for Republicans to force a marathon day, perhaps 12 hours or more of floor debate, before formalizing Biden's victory. The evening before, lawmakers peppered top Capitol security officials with questions. Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat from California, the chair of the House Administration Committee that oversees Capitol security, asked whether Capitol Police had enough officers to handle a crowd expected to reach 30,000, and if they had the National Guard on standby and available to help. Stephen Sund, the chief of Capitol Police, insisted that yes, they had both bases covered. By around 1 p.m., as the joint session began, the mood in the crowd outside had started to shift. Trump had just given a one-hour speech to thousands of supporters amassed on the ellipse near the White House, excoriating his enemies and reiterating his baseless claims of fraud. GOP lawmakers, he emphasized, needed to take a stand. Trump's supporters began streaming east on Pennsylvania Avenue. They first reached the west side of the building. The crowd grew 10 deep, then 20 deep, as the soon-to-be rioters spilled in along all sides of the Capitol, moving aside waist-high metal barriers. A seeming fortress from a distance, the Capitol contains more than 400 separate doors, entryways, and ground-level windows, and police lines on all sides of the building were collapsing. Before 1:30 p.m., Lofgren heard from staff that a wall of people had been able to push into the Capitol steps on the west side. Through the windows of the House chamber, Lofgren's aides could see outside that a ragtag group of rioters had climbed atop the risers and the platforms. Outside on the west side of the building, a handful of Capitol police officers had been backed into a corner, under the scaffolding holding up the inaugural stage. One was pulled down a set of stairs and then beaten and kicked while he tried to cover his head. Atop the stairs, another had his helmet ripped off as he tried to hold up the last remaining metal barrier before the crowd could flood into the building. A person in the mob sprayed something at an officer. Another lifted a hammer above his head as if preparing to throw it, and then instead began striking at the barrier where officers were holding it with their hands. House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving assured Lofgren that things would be fine. "The doors were all locked," he told her. "Nobody can get in," Irving said. Shortly before 2 p.m., rioters were on all sides of the building. They waved Trump flags from landings and porticos, while the most violent rained pipes, rocks, and other objects on the many doors and windows. One used a police shield to break a window. A rioter jumped through, followed by others who either used the window or nearby doors. On the second floor, Lofgren could see the mob encircling a landing. She didn't yet know protesters were inside. She again turned to Irving. What was going on? He said the National Guard was on its way. In fact, Sund had just requested National Guard support from the Defense Department. It would be hours before they would arrive. A moment later, the thunderous sounds of banging at exterior doors around the house side gave way to a crash of window glass, and then shouts from rioters who had breached a second side of the building. At 2:14 p.m., Representative Paul Gosar, Republican from Arizona, had begun his speech objecting to Arizona's Electoral College results. As he spoke, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's protective detail agents hustled her away. Moments later, there was yelling in the gallery as staff and security details started to move around with a heightened sense of alarm. Inside the chamber, news photographers that Pelosi had allowed in to capture the historic electoral vote at the dais instead turned around and trained their cameras toward the doors in the back of the chamber. As lawmakers were ushered out another side of the chamber, plainclothes Capitol Police officers dragged a desk to use as a barricade in front of the door that presidents entered to deliver the annual State of the Union address. On the other side, rioters began breaking small windows. The officers inside drew their guns. Dozens of rioters pressed against police trying to block their entry into Speaker's lobby. Several officers left their posts seconds before much more heavily armed reinforcements showed up. But in those few seconds, the rioters smashed in the windows of the doors to the Speaker's lobby and were on the verge of entering the House chamber. The intruders ran around the back hallways of the second floor, weaving in and out of the Senate Majority Leader and House Speaker's adjoining suites, and entering the sanctum of the two most powerful figures in Congress, like the halls were their playground. Eight Pelosi staffers trapped in their suite barricaded themselves inside a staff conference room and huddled together under a table in the middle, hoping that the protesters who had already broken down one door and were shooting selfies with their feet up on the assistant's desk wouldn't make it any further inside. Around 2 p.m. on the Senate side, Vice President Mike Pence was in the chair of the presiding officer when aides started motioning to Senator Charles Grassley, Republican from Iowa, who holds the largely ceremonial role of president pro tempore of the Senate, that he had to replace him. The vice president hurried out a door. At that moment, one floor below, rioters crashed through windows and climbed into the Capitol and clashed with police, including a lone black Capitol Police officer who tried to prevent them from ascending toward the Senate chamber. A video captured by Igor Bobik, a congressional reporter for HuffPost on the scene, shows the officer trying to hold back a few dozen rioters who push him back and up the steps, leading almost directly to the chamber. For almost a minute, the officer held them back. At the exact moment that inside the Senate, police were frantically racing around the chamber, trying to lock down more than a dozen doors leading to the chamber floor and the galleries above. "Second floor," the officer yelled into his radio, alerting other officers in command that the mob had reached the threshold of the Senate. Had rioters turned right, they would have been a few feet away from the main entrance into the Senate chamber. On the other side of that door were at least a half dozen armed officers, including one with an automatic weapon in the middle of the floor, scanning each entrance for intruders. Instead, the group, all white men, followed the black officer into the other direction and were met by a group of police in a back quarter outside the Senate. At 2:16 p.m., Bobbick tweeted a photo of a half dozen police confronting the protesters. The Senate chamber had been sealed at 2:15, mere seconds earlier. In the room with McConnell's aides, one staffer began snapping photos through a window. Outside in the hallway, the intruders kept coming, trying to open doors. The McConnell aides heard a woman praying loudly for the evil of Congress to be brought to an end. The senior McConnell advisor reached a former law firm colleague who had just left the Justice Department, Will Levi, who had served as Attorney General William Barr's chief of staff. They needed help now, he told Levi. From his home, Levi immediately called FBI Deputy Director David Bowditch, who was in the command center in the FBI's Washington field office. Capitol Police had said earlier that day they didn't need help, but Bowditch decided he couldn't wait for a formal invitation. He dispatched a tactical team to secure the safety of U.S. senators, with two more SWAT teams to follow. Get their asses over there. Go now, Bowditch told the first team's commander. We don't have time to huddle. From their secure locations, meanwhile, Pelosi, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, Democrat from Maryland, and Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer, the Democrat from New York, made calls for help. One went out to Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. Ralph, there's glass being broken around me, Northam recalled Pelosi saying. I've heard there's been gunfire. We're just very, very concerned right now. Amid the mayhem, a large group of senators were secretly led to a room in a Senate office building. Michael Stinger, the Senate Sergeant at Arms, was with them. How does this happen? Demanded Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina. Stinger's answer was practically inaudible. As Graham pressed, Stinger's voice got weaker and smaller. Here's your mission. Take back the Senate, Graham told Stinger. Whatever you need to do, do it. We're not leaving this place. We're not going to be run out by a mob. Finally, the Senate Sergeant at Arms sat down, saying to no one in particular, I wish I had just retired last week. Finally, by 6 p.m., a perimeter around the Capitol was secured. A few hours later, shaken lawmakers filed back in, surrounded by the wreckage of the day's attack. Smashed windows, splintered furniture, a bust of President Zachary Taylor smeared with what appeared to be blood. They went back to work. At 3:42 a.m., Vice President Mike Pence affirmed President-elect Joe Biden's victory. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's an obituary for all you baseball fans out there. The baseball manager who bled Dodger blue, Tommy Lasorda, 1927 to 2021. Tommy Lasorda never held back. During his 21 seasons as manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Hall of Famer became renowned for the profanity-laced tirades, or heart-to-heart talks, as he called them, he aimed at umpires and sports writers. Lasorda also berated his own players, but always made clear he loved them, embracing them after good plays and exhorting them to greater heights. That combination of hectoring and hugs proved a powerful motivator. After Lasorda took over the team late in the 1976 season, the Dodgers won National League pennants the following 2 years and World Series titles in 1981 and 88. A member of the Dodger organization for 8 decades, his belief in the team was total. Cut my veins, and I bleed Dodger blue, he said. If trouble comes, I pray to that big Dodger in the sky. Born to Italian immigrant parents in Norristown, Pennsylvania, the young Lasorda loved to do 2 things. fight, and play baseball, said the Washington Post. A left-handed pitcher, he signed with the Philadelphia Phillies out of high school, and for the next 14 seasons, bounced around the major and minor leagues, playing for a stint with the then Brooklyn Dodgers. Hired as a scout for the team in 1960, he rose steadily through the organization, becoming a minor league manager and then joining the big league club as a coach in 1973. Appointed manager 3 years later, Lasorda groomed a host of outstanding young players, said the New York Times. From 1973 to 1981, he managed one of baseball's most enduring infield alignments, with Steve Garvey at first base, David Lopez at second, Bill Russell at shortstop, and Ron Say at third. His management style was simple. If you treat players like human beings, Lasorda explained, they will play like Superman. A heart attack in 1996 ended his managerial career, said the Associated Press, and he retired with 1,599 career wins. But he remained a force with the Dodgers, representing the club at Goodwill events. Lasorda made his last on-field contribution when he coached the underdog 2000 U.S. Olympic team to gold in Sydney. His final ambition, he said, was to be buried under the pitcher's mound at Dodger Stadium. And when some little old left-hander's out there struggling, he'll hear a voice. Slow down, son. Concentrate. You can do it. And we'll skip on over to the Talking Points page with one article, The GOP Facing a Post-Trump Schism. The Capitol riot will go down as the day that broke the Republican Party as we know it, said Burgess Everett in Politico.com. After rampaging Trump supporters sent frightened legislators into hiding, the GOP faced its ultimate reckoning with Trumpism. Confronted with the damage wrought by Trump's anti-democratic authoritarianism and the loss of the presidency, the House, and now the Senate, the party must decide whether to continue embracing the ousted president or finally move on. How this war for the soul of the GOP will resolve is the central question now hovering over America's political landscape, said Michael Scherer in the Washington Post. At stake is whether the GOP will become an extension of QAnon or can emerge from the Trump era as a potential governing coalition built around ideas and some shared agreement on facts. Every Republican appalled by Trump's attempted coup must face a harsh reality, said Jonathan Last in the Bulwark.com. Many of their colleagues cheered it on. Despite no evidence of significant fraud, about half of the GOP's congressional delegation voted to overturn the presidential election, even after the sacking of the U.S. Capitol. A large faction of the party is literally in favor of authoritarianism. The old GOP is gone forever, said John Daniel Davidson in TheFederalist.com. Trump's 2016 win marked a profound shift in the Republican electorate, a populist uprising by rank-and-file voters fed up with the entrenched establishment beholden to a donor class that paid only lip service to their priorities. Safe borders, protecting workers from globalization, an end to foreign wars. By channeling their frustrations, Trump offered the party new life and a new direction, and that populist genie is not going back into the bottle. The GOP could really collapse, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. The implicit bargain of the Trump era required traditional Republicans to swallow a measure of insanity in exchange for a hold on power. But an increasingly unhinged GOP dominated by fantasies of a Trump revival in some form could become genuinely untenable for moderate suburbanites, corporate executives, and center-right Republicans like Senator Mitt Romney, and force them to jump ship. Many a prediction of the crack-up of American conservatism has come to naught. But breaking points do come. Time for a few short notes left. Starting with flu cases are down 98% in the U.S. this year, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The unprecedented decline was driven by mask wearing and other COVID preventative measures, fewer people traveling, and a record number of Americans receiving flu vaccinations. New data show that 2020 was tied with 2016 for the hottest year on record. The past 6 years are the sixth hottest on record. President Trump is the first chief executive since Herbert Hoover to preside over his party's loss of the White House, the House, and the Senate in a single term. He's also the first president since Hoover to leave the office with a net loss of jobs, with some 4 million lost since 2016. The Secret Service is swapping out several agents who guarded President Trump over concerns that their politics are too closely aligned with him. Joe Biden will be protected by agents who served him during his stint as vice president. And we'll finish out with a quote from Kurt Vonnegut, who says, "We are what we pretend to be, and so we must be careful what we pretend to be." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.